A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been thinking about Bill Bryson and what makes a travel book actually work. He grew up reading Bryson's travelogues across the U.S., and what hooked him wasn't the itinerary. It was the way Bryson made a place feel functional, alive, like you understood how people there actually lived. Not a list of things to see, not a photoreel, but the texture of a place. He wants to know who's doing that kind of work now. Contemporary writers covering more diverse places, more up-to-date accounts. People whose travel writing is less about checking boxes and more about encountering different ways of living, thinking, and being. So the question is really two things. What makes Bryson's approach so effective, and who's carrying that torch into places he never went?
The second question is the one that's going to surprise people, because the honest answer is, there's a lot. Travel writing is having a genuine moment right now. Smithsonian put out their 10 best travel books of 2025, and the range is remarkable. Book Riot ran a whole roundup of travel memoirs specifically by writers who aren't, quote, the usual white dudes. Condé Nast Traveler did a feature on how the genre is being reshaped by writers coming at it from completely different angles. So Daniel's timing is actually perfect. If you haven't checked in on travel writing since Bryson, you're walking into a renaissance.
Which isn't what most people would guess. The assumption is that Instagram killed the travelogue. Why read 200 pages about someone's road trip when you can watch 60 seconds of drone footage set to music?
And that assumption gets it exactly backwards. The drone footage shows you what a place looks like. Bryson shows you what it feels like to be there, and more importantly, what it means to be there. Those are completely different products. A travel reel is a postcard. A travel book is, I don't know, an apprenticeship. You're spending enough time in someone's head, in their observations, that you start to absorb how they see. That's not something a 90-second video can do, no matter how well it's edited.
The apprenticeship is the right word. Bryson doesn't just describe a diner in Iowa. He sits in it, talks to the waitress, notices what's on the menu, what's playing on the radio, what the parking lot looks like, and then connects all of that to something larger about American economic geography. You finish the chapter, and you haven't just seen the diner. You've understood something about the town it's in.
And the mechanism he uses to pull that off is really specific. He makes the familiar strange and the strange familiar. That's the whole engine. When he's in a small Midwestern town, he finds the extraordinary in the ordinary, the historical plaque that reveals some insane local feud, the roadside attraction that's a monument to someone's very specific obsession. Then when he's somewhere genuinely strange, like, say, the Appalachian Trail in winter, he makes it relatable by being completely out of his depth and very funny about it. He's the guy who packed the wrong gear and almost died and is now telling you about it at a party.
The self-deprecation is structural, not just decorative. It disarms you. You're not being lectured by an expert. You're following a guy who's curious and frequently wrong and willing to admit it. That creates permission for the reader to be curious too. You're not supposed to already know things. You're supposed to be discovering them alongside him.
And that's the first thing that separates travel literature from a travel guide. A guide tells you where to go. Good travel literature tells you what it felt like to be there. Great travel literature tells you something about yourself in the process of telling you about the place. Bryson's books are closer to ethnography than itinerary. They capture the contradictions of a place, the rhythms, the things people argue about at town meetings.
Take a walk in the woods. On the surface, it's a book about hiking the Appalachian Trail. But the trail is really a spine for a whole series of digressions about American wilderness, the history of the National Park Service, the people who are drawn to long-distance hiking and why, the towns that exist along the trail and what they reveal about rural economies. The hiking is almost incidental.
The Lost Continent is even more explicit about this. He's driving around small-town America, but he's really writing about the gap between the myth of small-town America and the reality. The towns that are dying, the ones that have been turned into tourist versions of themselves, the ones that are just holding on. It's not a travel book about where to go. It's a travel book about what happened here.
Which brings us to what Daniel's actually asking for. He wants that same depth, the functional understanding, the encounter with different ways of living. But from writers who are covering places and communities, Bryson never really touched. The American South in ways that aren't just about barbecue and charm. The borderlands, indigenous communities, immigrant experiences, places where the travel writing isn't just about the place, but about identity and memory and belonging.
And this is where the genre has expanded. The Book Riot Roundup includes writers like Khao Kalia Young, who wrote about returning to Laos as a Hmong American. It's a travel memoir that's really about displacement and memory and what it means to visit a home you were too young to remember leaving. Sloane Crosley's work is much funnier and more in the Bryson vein, but she's writing from a perspective that the genre didn't traditionally make room for. The Sea and Traveler feature highlights how the old model, usually a man, usually white, usually from a wealthy country, going somewhere exotic and reporting back, is being replaced by something much more interesting.
The old model had a built-in problem. The writer was always an outsider looking in. The new voices are often writing from the inside, or from the border between inside and outside. They're not discovering a place, they're reckoning with it.
And that produces a fundamentally different kind of book. When Bryson writes about small-town America, he's an Iowan who's been away and come back. He's got standing. But when he writes about Australia or Britain, he's the outsider, and the book works because he's so transparent about that. The new generation of writers often has a much more complicated relationship with the places they're writing about. They might be returning to a country their parents fled. They might be traveling through communities that see them as belonging and not belonging at the same time. That tension generates insight that the old outsider model couldn't reach.
So let's get specific. Daniel wants names. Who should he be reading?
I'd start with the Smithsonian 2025 list because it's curated and recent. The books on there blend memoir, history, and reportage in ways that feel very Bryson-adjacent, even when the voices are completely different. Several of them are about how climate change, migration, and economic shifts are transforming American places right now. That's exactly the functional understanding Daniel's after, just updated for what's actually happening.
Give me one or two that really stand out.
There's a book on the list about the Colorado River Basin that's essentially a travelogue through the American West's water crisis. The writer visits the communities, talks to the farmers and the tribal leaders and the water managers, and the book becomes a portrait of an entire region trying to figure out whether it has a future. That's Bryson-level craft applied to the most urgent question in the American West. Another one traces the path of a single highway through the South, but the writer is from one of the communities along it, and the book is as much about family history and racial geography as it's about the road itself.
That second one gets at something important. Bryson's genius was finding the extraordinary in the ordinary, the roadside attraction that reveals something about American character. These new writers are doing the same thing, but the ordinary they're working with is different. It's the ordinary of communities that haven't been written about, or have been written about badly.
The Book Riot list is even more explicit about this. It's organized around the idea that the usual travel writer has a specific demographic profile, and that profile has shaped what kinds of places get written about and how. When you expand who's doing the writing, you expand what counts as a travel story. A memoir about visiting family in rural China becomes travel literature. A book about driving through the Navajo Nation to understand a parent's history becomes travel literature. The genre gets bigger and more interesting.
I want to push on something, though. Is this just a diversity argument, or is there a craft argument underneath it? Because Daniel's not asking for diverse writers as an abstract good. He's asking for writers who can deliver that Bryson-level experience of feeling like you understand how a place functions.
It's absolutely a craft argument. Different perspectives produce different observations. A writer who speaks the local language notices things a monolingual writer misses. A writer who looks like the people in the community they're visiting has different conversations than a writer who stands out. A writer who's returning to a place their family left has access to emotional registers that a first-time visitor doesn't. All of that's craft. It's not about checking boxes, it's about the quality of the observation.
That's fair. The best travel writing is inherently subjective anyway. The idea that the ideal travel writer is some kind of objective blank slate is, I mean, it's not even wrong, it's just nonsensical. The writer's perspective is the whole point.
And this is one of the misconceptions that really needs to be stomped on. People sometimes talk about travel writing as if it's journalism, and there's a journalistic element to it. You should get the facts right, the diner should actually exist. But the best travel writing is closer to memoir. The writer's interior landscape is at least as important as the exterior one. Bryson isn't giving you an objective report on the Appalachian Trail, he's giving you Bill Bryson on the Appalachian Trail. The personality is the product.
Which is why bad travel writing is so bad. It's just a list of things that happened, with no filter, no perspective, no reason for this particular person to be telling you this particular story. It's a blog post that got a book deal.
The filter is everything. And the filter is shaped by who the writer is, where they're from, what they notice, what they find funny, what they find moving. When you read across a wider range of writers, you're not just learning about more places, you're learning more ways of seeing. A road trip through the same stretch of Texas produces a completely different book depending on whether the writer is a white guy from Connecticut or a Tejano whose family has been there for six generations.
So where does Daniel actually find these books? He's in Jerusalem. He's not browsing the travel section at a Barnes & Noble.
The independent presses are doing a lot of the interesting work here. A lot of the books on the Smithsonian list and the Book Riot Roundup are from smaller publishers that specialize in place-based writing. Literary journals are another good source. Orion, for example, publishes a lot of travel-adjacent essays that are really about how people relate to landscapes and communities. And honestly, the online ecosystem for this stuff is better than it's ever been. There are newsletters and substacks by writers who are essentially doing serialized travel literature, often from places that traditional publishing hasn't gotten to yet.
The newsletter thing is interesting. It's almost a return to the 18th century model, where travel writing was serialized and readers would follow along as the writer moved through a place. Bryson himself started in newspapers. His early travel pieces ran in the Des Moines Register before they became books.
The form is flexible. It doesn't have to be a 300-page hardcover. Some of the best travel writing happening right now is in pieces, in real time, from writers who are embedded in a place for months or years and reporting back as they go. That's actually closer to how Bryson worked than the finished book model suggests.
Let's talk about the American South for a second, because Daniel specifically mentioned wanting accounts from more diverse places, and the South is one of those regions where the gap between the tourist version and the lived reality is enormous.
The South gets flattened in travel writing more than almost anywhere else in the country. It's either charming small towns with front porches and sweet tea, or it's a dateline for something terrible. The reality is vastly more complicated, and the writers who are doing the best work there are the ones who live there and are writing from the inside. They're covering the New South, the immigrant communities that have transformed towns in Georgia and North Carolina, the rural areas that are being reshaped by climate change and economic shifts, the cities that are grappling with their histories in ways that are new.
The borderlands are another space where the new travel writing is doing work that Bryson never really attempted. The U.S.-Mexico border is a place, not just a political abstraction. It's got towns and ecosystems and communities that exist on both sides. And there are writers who spent years traveling it and writing about what it actually looks and feels like to be there.
And indigenous communities. There's a whole body of travel writing now by native writers who are visiting reservations and tribal lands and writing about what they find. That's a perspective that was almost entirely absent from the genre until recently, and it's producing some of the most interesting work. It's travel writing that's also about sovereignty, about land, about what it means to visit a place that your ancestors were removed from.
The through line in all of this is the same thing Bryson was doing, using travel as a way to ask bigger questions. The questions are just different now. They're about identity and belonging and change, rather than just about what's weird and wonderful about America.
Although Bryson asked those questions too. The Lost Continent is full of anxiety about what America was becoming. He's driving through towns that have been hollowed out by Walmart, watching regional cultures get replaced by national chains, and he's upset about it. The humor is a delivery system for real grief about the homogenization of American life.
He's mourning something. That's what makes the book stick with you. It's funny, but it's also sad. The roadside attractions he loves are disappearing. The local diners are being replaced by Applebee's, and he's documenting it as it happens.
and that's a mode that the new generation of travel writers has really picked up. A lot of the best work right now is about places in transition, communities that are losing their identity, or gaining a new one, or fighting over which version of themselves they want to be. Climate change is a huge part of this. The Colorado River book I mentioned is essentially a travelogue through a slow-motion disaster. The writer visits places that might not exist in 20 years, and the book becomes a record of what's being lost.
That's a long way from 10 best beaches in Thailand.
It is, and that's the point. The genre has grown up. It's not just about leisure and escape anymore. It's about understanding how places work and why they matter, which, honestly, is what Bryson was doing all along. He just did it with better jokes.
He did do it with better jokes. The humor isn't a small thing. It's what makes the medicine go down.
And that's the one thing I'd say the new generation could learn from him. Some of the contemporary travel writing is very serious, sometimes to a fault. Bryson understood that if you want people to care about the decline of small-town America, you have to make them laugh first. The laughter creates the emotional investment, and then you can break their heart a little.
The writers who do both, who can be funny and insightful in the same paragraph, are still rare. Bryson was unusual in that respect. Most travel writers are either comedians who happen to be traveling, or serious observers who happen to be on the road. Bryson was both.
Sloane Crosley gets close. Her essays have that same self-deprecating humor, the same willingness to be the butt of the joke, and then she'll pivot into something sharp about the place she's in. But she's writing shorter pieces mostly. The full-length Bryson-style travelogue that's both hilarious and deeply researched is a hard thing to pull off.
It's a high-wire act. You have to be a good enough researcher to get the facts right, a good enough writer to make the prose sing, and a good enough comedian to land the jokes. Most people have one or two of those. Bryson had all three.
And he made it look easy, which is the most annoying thing about him.
The mark of someone who revised heavily.
Nobody writes sentences that clean on the first pass. But that's craft, not magic. It's learnable. And I think that's actually encouraging for someone like Daniel who wants to find new writers in this vein. The tools Bryson used, close observation, self-deprecation, genuine curiosity, the willingness to be wrong, those are available to anyone. The question is just who's using them and where they're pointing their attention.
Which brings us back to the practical question. If Daniel wants to start reading tomorrow, where does he begin?
I'd say start with the Smithsonian 2025 list and pick the book that covers a place you're already curious about. That's the entry point. Then follow the threads, see who those writers cite, who they're in conversation with, what presses are publishing the work you like. The ecosystem is discoverable if you pay attention to who's publishing what. Book Riot's Roundup is a good second stop, especially if you want to make sure you're not just reading variations on the same perspective. And then the literary journals. Orion, as I mentioned, but also places like The Believer and N+1 sometimes run travel-adjacent essays that are doing really interesting things with the form.
The form itself is expanding. It's not just books anymore. It's newsletters. It's long-form essays. It's audio documentaries that are essentially travelogues for the ear. Daniel might find that the thing he loved about Bryson shows up in formats Bryson himself never worked in.
The audio space is doing some really interesting travel-adjacent work. Not just podcasts about travel tips, but narrative audio that's essentially a travelogue with sound design. It's immersive in a way that even Bryson couldn't be on the page.
Though Bryson on the page is still pretty immersive. That's the thing about good writing. It doesn't need sound design. The prose does the work.
It does. And that's why the genre isn't dying. As long as there are writers who can make you feel like you're somewhere, people will want to read them. The delivery mechanism might change, but the fundamental transaction, one person's curious encounter with a place, rendered in language good enough to make you feel it, that's not going anywhere.
All right. Hilbert's been quiet back there. I know that look. What have you got?
I fact-checked for a travel magazine in the late 90s.
Of course you did.
It was called American Wanderer. Folded in 2002. My job was to call the motels and the diners and verify that the writer had actually been there. You'd be surprised how often they hadn't.
How often?
More than half. Maybe two-thirds. The writers would file these beautiful pieces about diners that had closed 3 years earlier. Conversations with locals who turned out to be composites of three different people. Descriptions of sunsets that happened on a Tuesday when the writer's credit card receipts showed they were in a different state. I kept the file.
What did you do when you caught one?
Nothing, mostly. The editor didn't want to know. He said the truth of a piece wasn't in the facts. He said a writer could capture the truth of a town better by inventing a diner than by describing a real one. I didn't agree with him, but he signed the checks.
Do you agree with him now?
I don't know. I think about it differently than I used to. There was one piece. A writer described a conversation with an old man at a gas station in eastern Oregon. Beautiful piece. The old man said things about the land, about what it was like before the timber industry collapsed. I called the gas station, and the owner said nobody matching that description had worked there in 15 years. But the things the old man said in the piece, they were true. They were exactly what happened to those towns. The writer just put the words in a mouth that wasn't there to speak them.
So the piece was accurate about the place, and inaccurate about the conversation.
And where do you land on that?
I wrote a piece myself once. Road trip through the Pacific Northwest. I interviewed a man at a diner in Coeur d'Alene, and the conversation was so boring I couldn't use it. So I made up a better one. I've never told anyone that before.
Does that make you a fraud or a travel writer?
I don't know. I think about that diner a lot. The real one had good pie. I put that in the piece. That part was true.
What happened to the magazine?
Folded. The editor went to work for an airline magazine. I went back to school. I still have the file, though. The one with the discrepancies. It's in a box somewhere.
I'd like to see that file.
It's not as interesting as you think. Mostly, it's just dates and phone numbers and the word no written next to things.
The word no next to a description of a sunset is pretty interesting to me.
It was a Tuesday sunset on a Thursday. That's the kind of thing I wrote down.
So the best travel writing might be partly fiction, and the writers know it, and the editors know it, and the fact-checkers know it, and the readers are the only ones who don't.
I think the readers know. I think they just don't care. They want to feel like they were there. If the pie was good, the rest is negotiable.
I'm going to be thinking about that for a while.
The pie was very good. Huckleberry.
The question that leaves me with, and I don't have an answer, is whether AI-generated travel content makes this whole conversation irrelevant. If a language model can produce a convincing description of a diner in Coeur d'Alene without ever having been there, and if readers don't care whether the diner is real, what's the value of the human travel writer at all?
I think the value is exactly what Hilbert just described. The AI can generate the diner. It can't eat the pie. The fact that Hilbert ate the pie, that a specific person on a specific day in a specific town had a specific experience, that's the thing that can't be faked. Even if the conversation at the next table was invented, the pie was real. The writer was there. The AI wasn't.
So the presence of the writer is the irreducible core of the genre.
It always has been. Bryson's books work because Bryson was there. He really did hike parts of the trail. He really did drive through those towns. Some of the conversations might be tidied up, some of the timing might be compressed, but the body was in the place. That's the contract with the reader. The writer went there so you don't have to, or so you'll want to. The AI hasn't gone anywhere.
That's the closing thought, I think. The best travel writing doesn't just show you a place. It changes how you see your own. And that requires a person on the other end of the sentence. Someone who ate the pie.
Someone who ate the pie and can tell you whether it was worth the drive. That's the whole thing. Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing, and for the file in the box that we're all now curious about.
This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com. Or email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.